child death due to waterborne diseases remains quite high in many countries. So what you want people to do is, once the water is in a container where they're going to be storing it at home for a couple of days, you want them to put some chlorine in it. We ask parents about the incidence of diarrhea, vomiting, fever among young kids, and we find a substantial decrease of 20 to 25%.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Almost 2 billion people don't have access to clean water, which means, of course, they're at an increased risk of disease, especially young children. We can provide chemicals to disinfect that water, but what's the best way to make sure that as many people as possible take up that opportunity? Work in Malawi compared the impact of health of two common delivery methods, and it might surprise you when you find out what works best. Pascaline Dupin of Stanford was one of the researchers, and she joins me now. Pascaline, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
What sort of diseases are we talking about here that are spread in unclean water, and how many people, who do they affect?
So the most common disease that you get from unclean water is diarrhea. I think everyone knows that. You can have more serious stuff like cholera, typhoid, that comes with diarrhea, but also fever, vomiting, and things like that. And obviously, children are going to be the most vulnerable to this because, you know, they are smaller, their bodies are less used to things and less resistant. So child death due to waterborne diseases remains quite high in many countries.
And of course, it isn't practical to build a main supply for 2 billion people. So I mentioned that there are chemicals available. How do we make safe this water?
Essentially, what you want people to do is to just treat the water in their home. So they have to go get the water somewhere. Sometimes they may have a borehole in their home. In such case, the water may be clean already if it's coming from a deep enough source. But many people need to get water from shallow sources, from a river or from a central place in the village, and then they carry it home. And even if the water was clean initially on the way home, it may get dirty, or the containers in which they put it may be dirty. So what you want people to do is, once the water is in a container where they're going to be storing it at home for a couple of days, you want them to put some chlorine in it. Chlorine is like diluted bleach. It's just going to kill all the germs in there for a while and prevent them from coming back.
And in low-income countries, when this chlorine is available, is everybody using it?
Not everybody uses it if they have it, because it's a little bit of a hassle. First, you have to dose it right. We are used to use chlorine when we go hiking, for example, and you want to clean your water, you put some chlorine pill in there. Yeah. It leaves a taste. And then if you are a bit cautious and you put a little bit more than needed just to be safe, it leaves a bigger taste. And so we found in a previous study in Kenya 10 years ago that less than half of households, when they get chlorine given to them, put it to use on a regular basis. And the other half, some of them don't need to treat their water. Their water is already clean. A few households like to boil water instead. That's kind of rare. And some households just don't like the taste that the water, or feel like maybe the chlorine test is more harmful than the germs themselves.
You tested ways, as I mentioned in the introduction, to improve this uptake in Malawi. One method that you used was to ask community health workers to deliver the purification products. Now, who are these workers, and why, in theory, is it a good idea to make use of them?
Right now, households have to go to the store and buy the chlorine treatment if they want to use it. From a lot of research that we've been doing over the past 10, 15 years, we know that if people have to pay regularly to buy preventative products, it's difficult for them to do that. So if they have to buy it already, that's a huge barrier. So the first barrier you want to remove is the cost, the monetary cost. You want to make this chlorine free and say, okay, just, you have a small child, here it is, you can have it for free. But then if you do that and you give it to everybody, and you know that just about half or less than half are going to use it, then you can be worried that you're kind of like wasting a little bit your subsidy money. So the key question is, how do you target so that people who are interested in the product get it for free and then use it, and people who are not interested in the product, you don't bother giving it to them? But you may say, well, no, don't give it too quickly. People who are not using it, maybe they don't fully understand why they should be using it. So maybe if you give it to them through these community health workers whose job it is to educate households, to look at their health, make sure that they go to the hospital when they need to. They are supposed to visit households once a week or so. You know, maybe you can exploit these community health workers to increase usage among households. And so that's what we kind of looked at, is the extent to which asking these community health workers to not only distribute this free chlorine on a regular basis to households, but also encourage them to use it, remind them of why it's a good idea, train them on how to dose it right. All of that could make a difference.
The alternative strategy was a more basic one, is to give coupons for the chlorine. Who's getting the coupons? How do they exchange them? What are the advantages for this method?
Yeah, so the alternative is to tell households, okay, you are eligible for free chlorine because you have small kids. So you can just come every month to this store and get a free bottle of chlorine against a coupon. And so how do you deliver the coupons? In the context of our study, we did it by, you know, going to households and giving them a booklet of coupons for a whole 18 months. That was because we needed to survey these households in any case at the beginning to have an idea of who they are, measure their health outcomes. But in practice, if you want to do this at scale, you would want the government to just provide these booklets of coupons to households through prenatal clinics or postnatal clinics. So as soon as a woman gives birth or is pregnant, you know she is going to have a child soon enough, you could immediately provide that booklet of free coupons. The same way many clinics in many countries provide a free bed net to a pregnant woman when she shows up for prenatal care. So the very same model could be used to just hand out the coupons. And then they have to be redeemed. And so the question is, where do you redeem these coupons? In the context of our study, they could be redeemed in local stores. And in a small store where you buy your flour, you buy your washing powder, you could also redeem the coupons for chlorine. That requires setting up an agreement with the stores so that they know, you know, they can give you the free chlorine in exchange for the coupons, and they are guaranteed that someone is going to come and, you know, give them the money in exchange for the coupons. Setting that up at scale through a government program may be a bit trickier than it was for us as researchers. So a first step would be, okay, let's at minimum say the coupons can be redeemed at the health center, where women often come with children in any case. Where you redeem the coupon, that's something that's a choice in the design of the program that can vary with the context.
Well, it's a very interesting experimental setup because it really does expose the policy challenges. First of all, for results, what was the uptake like for the coupons? How does that translate into better health?
Just about 35% of households redeem their coupons on a regular basis. So the many households redeem the first coupon, and then some households are like, well, we don't like it so much, so then they don't redeem the second coupon. But the households who you keep going and redeem their coupons, it's about 30-35%. They do this very regularly. Mm-hmm. And then they are also the households that do use the product. So when we show up at their house unannounced and we test the water, their stored drinking water, we can see whether there is some residual chlorine in it, and that tells us whether they've used it. And so we find a very high rate of usage among the people who've redeemed the coupons. And that's what was precisely the objective of the coupon program, is to say, you can get it for free if you want to use it. If you don't want to use it, then presumably you're not going to bother redeeming the coupon. And so we get the best of both worlds. We get free chlorine for the people who want it without wasting free chlorine on the people who don't want it. So that works very well. And that was surprisingly identical to what we had found in a previous study in Kenya 10 years prior, where we had piloted this coupon program and had found pretty much the same numbers. About 30-35% of households would redeem the coupons, and those households would be using the chlorine and the others would not. What we had not been able to do in the Kenya study 10 years ago was to look at the effects over time, see whether they persisted, and see whether they translate into changes in health outcomes. So in the Malawi study, we were able to replicate these initial findings and then to look over 18 months whether the usage continued for these households. We find that it does, and then we can measure health outcomes. We ask parents about the incidence of diarrhea, vomiting, fever among young kids, and we find a substantial decrease of 20-25% for young kids, which is very, very promising.
Which is great. Absolutely. Yeah. And that is very encouraging. But some people will say, well, that's one in three households. And if we want three in three households, do we have to look more intensively at this? And of course, community health workers seems like the obvious way to do that. It's being delivered. There's educational context to it. Did the community health workers improve uptake beyond that?
No, it did not. It did not. Disappointing news, which says that if you try to encourage more households to use this product and nudge them and remind them and borderline bully them, because you can think of these community health workers as being able to kind of really tell people, no, you should do this. It doesn't make any difference. And so it seems like households have pretty strong set preferences over this. And households who do not use it, even when it's free, do this very thoughtfully. And so trying to change their behavior through community health workers doesn't work in this context. You can see this as being evidence of households already having gotten all the information that they needed through the existing prenatal, postnatal care. And so that kind of like speaks well of the existing system. Like they already get all the information. You don't need to have this additional layer of information through the community health workers. And so then I guess it opens the question of like what more could be done so that more households use it. What I can't tell you is whether it should be 100% of households using it or just 60% or 50%. You know, I'm telling you it's 35% of households, but it doesn't mean that it's only one in a third who's protected. Because, you know, some households may already have clean water and some households know that their water is fine. Most of the time, they will only use the chlorine during a cholera outbreak. So, you know, it's not clear that the goal is 100% take up. Mm-hmm. It varies across contexts as well. To me, the main takeaway from this is that if you introduce a coupon program, you increase chlorine usage from, you know, 5% to 30% or 35%, which is a huge increase.
Yeah.
At a very small cost. It's a very cost-effective program. Then the question of how do you make even more households use it when they need it is like a separate question that seems to be quite tricky to make progress on, since the most obvious, easy, straightforward way, which is to get community health workers to nudge people, doesn't make a difference.
I would imagine the community health workers, it's a lot more expensive to do that. And if they're not getting an additional result, is this an argument against community health workers?
So I wouldn't say that. The way we did it, they are not expensive. If you set up a community health workers program just for that, then yes, it would be a very expensive way to not get as big results as with the coupons. But the idea going in was to say, well, there's already these community health workers. They are already going to households on a regular basis. We can just add on this responsibility. And so the marginal cost is very, very small, because it's just maybe they spend like 5 more minutes in every household, every visit to tell them about this. So if it worked, it would be a very, very easy to do it and very cheap thing to do. Now, maybe it's not so cheap from the point of view of the community health workers, because they already have a lot of things on their plate. They have a very long list of things that they are supposed to be doing with households. And so maybe from their point of view, it was kind of like one more responsibility that means that they are stressed out and maybe takes away from some of the other things they are supposed to do. That's not something that we were able to look at and measure because it was outside the scope of our study. But many countries have community health workers. If they already visit households, adding one small thing to their plate is a good idea. But if it doesn't make a difference, then, you know, let's not bother.
And as you say, the coupon delivery program achieved an enormous amount of success. It's an inexpensive program, perhaps. But if you were in charge of scaling this up and you wanted to maximize the benefit of coupon delivery, how would you design that?
Yeah, so we actually are hoping to scale that up in various contexts. We are working right now, trying to reach out to governments to do this. We are hoping to get going in Kenya very soon. So the first thing is to embed the delivery of the coupon themselves into the existing healthcare system. And so my own view is that using the prenatal care system is the best bet, because that's how you can target households with young children. And then the key question that we hope to work on next is whether it's necessary to set up a redemption system through shops, local shops, or whether you can entirely rely on the existing healthcare system. And the potential downside of only using the healthcare system is that the density of clinics is lower than the density of shops. So if I say you have to go to the clinic to redeem your coupon, then on average, you're going to have to travel more to redeem your coupon. The clinic may be 3 kilometers away, whereas everybody has a shop, you know, within less than that. So that's the key question. Like if we make it too much of a hassle, you know, you have to go and redeem your coupon once a month. You know, that's a hassle This is precisely the hassle that makes sure that if you don't care about it, you won't bother redeeming the coupon that saves us money as the person subsidizing. But we don't want it to be too much of a hassle that you just give up entirely. And so finding that right kind of balance is very important. So we're going to try and see, okay, if we just rely on the healthcare system, do we end up losing a bunch of households who live just too far away? And for those, then setting up things through shops may be critical. So those are the questions from the scale-up standpoint that we want to explore next.
Well, good luck in scaling that up. It's such a valuable project, but there's a lot of work to be done, isn't there? So good luck with it, Pascalina.
Thanks.
And thank you very much for breaking into your holiday to talk to me about it on Fox Dev Talks.
No problem. My pleasure. Thanks so much for your great questions.
If you want to read about this, then the paper's called Expanding Access to Clean Water for the Rural Poor, Experimental Evidence from Malawi. And the authors are Pascaline Dupin, Basimenya Nyalema, Zachary Wagner, Aaron Wolf, and Emily Rowe. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find us. And all our past episodes are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the papers we feature.